If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to the Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by two guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Arison. I ate some almonds right before we started recording, and I'm realizing that my teeth are full of little fragments of almonds, and I'm very uncomfortable.
This episode of The Greatest Generation brought to you by almonds in Ben's mouth. That's right, the recording artist's friend for over 60 years, the Almond Growers of America, thank you for your patronage.
The famously union-busting almond growers, isn't that?
Oh, no.
Aren't almond growers like kind of bad, generally?
You're going to put us on the opposite end of Big Almond, Ben.
Yeah.
I don't want to be crushed under their nutty fingers.
Those big almond guys will break your knees like cracking a shell.
I'm way more afraid of Big Almond than Big Rod.
We've stared into the face of Big Rod and lived to tell the tale, so
you know. Big Rod's like Sauron if Sauron wore a dorky t-shirt.
Charged $40 for his own signature.
Yeah.
Like, who gives a fuck?
Hey, I'm Frank Stallone. I'm looking at the judges' table during the slam dunk contest.
Well, the crowd lets you know what they think of it. Now we will wait for the judges.
It was like a 4.8 on a 10-point scale.
Yeah. Adam, I heard tell that that you went to our P.O. box recently. Was there anything in it?
I've been out of town for a long time, and I came back to a box full of mail, Ben. Let's get that stuff opened.
Let's open that shit up.
Captain, I'm sorry to disturb you.
I'm receiving a code 47.
Verify.
It is code 47, sir. Starfleet emergency frequency.
Captain's eyes only.
Ben, on the very top of the stack was a postcard from our good friend Ann Kilzer, one of the best friends of DeSoto.
Yeah, Ann Kilzer's one of the greats.
Ann Kilzer's still in Japan.
We got to meet her on our last tour. Right?
Yeah.
What city was she in when we met her? Do you remember?
I remember meeting her most clearly at Max FunCon East, but I'm almost positive we met her before that.
Yeah.
At another show.
Well, she's now in Japan, which is not on the Greatest Gen Con touring schedule, unfortunately.
I think after this postcard, you might want to change your mind about that, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Message goes like this. Dear Adam and Ben, I'm writing from Shimoda, Japan.
What?
After surfing and swimming in the ocean, life's good. I found a job and got a 5-year visa.
Wow.
I remember that being very much in question last time we heard from Anne, so I'm glad that worked out for her. She continues, your show brings me joy, and I'm catching up with the DS9. Come visit Japan! Exclamation point.
Hell yeah.
I want to revisit Japan so bad, Ben. Anne, I don't want to ask too much of you. It sounds like you're a busy person. But if in your travels throughout Shimoda and parts non-Shimoda in Japan, if you find a place that would be appropriate for a Greatest Gen show, I'm willing to consider the possibility.
Do you think we could sell 50 tickets in Japan?
Ben, if we sold 50 tickets in Japan, I will say right now that I would go and do that show.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tax write-off, right? If we,
yeah.
That's like a government-subsidized trip to Japan.
I'm no tax professional, and I'm famously terrible with money, so sure, I'm ready to believe that.
Yeah, just take it from me, Adam.
I'm glad I trust you so much, Ben.
It would definitely be a money-losing proposition, but not that bad of a money-losing proposition.
I've lost more money for less valid reasons.
What if we went to Japan and found out we were like a huge deal there, and we just never knew because we have crappy analytics on our podcast host?
Huge in Japan is one of the only ways that I want to talk about myself. So that would be great.
That would be really fun. Wow, that's so great to hear that Ann Kilzer is having a great time over there. Do we have any other mail?
Yeah, we do. We've got two more packages, Ben. I'm opening up the second. What we have here is a photo mailer sent to us from Emily out of San Antonio, Texas. And there is a letter in an envelope and also a challenge coin, Ben.
Woo.
This challenge coin on one side says, Black Knights, checkmate. And on the other side, it says, Commander's Coin of Excellence, 93rd Intelligence SQ.
Whoa.
A beautiful and substantial coin. The greeting card says, Hi, on the front. And the letter inside says, Dear Adam and Ben, I recently received my FOD challenge coin, and it's so lovely. I wanted to send this along.
Oh, so she must have come to one of our Texas shows.
Yeah.
Because we didn't get the coins made in time for our Texas shows, so we had to mail them out. And by the way, we've had one return to sender, and I think we sorted that out, and one that we heard from the person that it didn't show up, and so I sent out another. But if you came to one of our Texas shows and you're wondering if your coin is still on its way, if you haven't gotten it yet, send us a tweet or something, because it may have gotten lost in the mail.
The letter continues, traditionally, challenge coins, or RMOs, as they're known in some circles, are given in recognition of good work or are exchanged with new acquaintances from distant duty stations.
Yeah.
In light of that, please think of my payment as a donation to the cause and accept this RMO. And then in parentheses, she's like, round metal object, if you're curious. That's great. From my own collection. Thanks for everything. And when will we get a friendly fire one? Asks Emily. That's a great question.
Yeah, the friendly fire challenge coin is an object that is definitely going to be created at some point.
Got to be a pork chop on one side of that challenge coin, you gotta believe, right?
Is that heads or tails?
I feel like that's heads. I don't know why, and I don't know why I'm so positive about that, but yeah.
Adam, it's a beautiful coin. Thank you for Jackie and Laurieing it to me.
Hey, don't thank me. Thank Emily in San Antonio. We got one final package here, Ben. It was sent internationally. And while on the packaging it says, do not bend, !! double underlined. It looks like it's really been through some shit, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's torn in places, but I'm not going to let that stop me from enjoying opening this one up from Dean. I'm going to use one of the holes in the packaging to finish the open job. Oh, boy. What is spilled out are a number of slips of paper that says, this is your own fault.
Okay.
That's mildly disturbing.
Is there, like, ricin in there also?
This is your own fault. I will, Jackie and Lori, you some pictures of this. Just so you have some documentation of what caused my death.
This is really creepy.
Yeah. Maybe I'll go to the letter before opening this up. It's from Dean from somewhere in the old U of K. Adam and Ben, hey guys. I couldn't think of better recipients for the contents of this little package. I'm just going to turn back to you, Ben, and say, not making me feel any better. I long recalled the sight of these at my mother's house, always wondering not so much how she acquired them, but why she kept them. Again, Ben, not helping.
No, getting creepier, if
anything.
Now
they have come to me, and I knew that an unseen hand was working to only one end. They are destined for you guys. I'm reliably informed that these will work perfectly until 2025. Until then, enjoy. Hopefully we will still be enjoying the quality pod by then too. Keep up the great work. Dean, it sort of ended more encouragingly.
Yeah, sort of.
I feel like I should put on gloves. But I also feel like it's too late for me now. Oh, and what we've got are two Deep Space Nine wall calendars from 1997.
Ugh.
How about that? Unopened.
Wow. Have they been harmed by the abuse that the package took, or?
No, they're in great shape.
Wow.
I'm wondering if the package wasn't opened and all of the "this is your own fault" strips of paper were crammed in into those holes. Because I do not understand what that has to do with anything else.
Well, it's that we started an embarrassing Star Trek podcast, and he's holding us responsible for him having mailed this to us.
Wow. Well, hopefully having opened his package, we can cut to Dean scratching me off his list of people to kill.
I wonder, like, when we can bust out our Deep Space Nine calendars again.
Years with the same calendar as 1997 are 2003, 2014, 2025.
Oh, we have a little bit of time.
Ben, I've been a fool for throwing away my calendars up until now.
Yeah, what a waste of money, Adam. Are you fucking nuts?
Wow, well, thanks for those calendars and the other stuff. Dean, we really appreciate it. If you have stuff you would like to send us, we have a P.O. box whose address I will not give out on the podcast. It's easy enough to find, though. Contact a friend of DeSoto for that information, and I'm sure they'll be happy to give it to you.
Yeah.
Much like the P.O. box address, so too is the first episode of the third season of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, entitled The Search, Part 1.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
It's a season that begins like the end of season 2 is a cliffhanger, right?
Yeah.
There was no Riker saying fire, but it definitely feels like a brief recap.
It's not a cliffhanger per se in that there's not, like, continuing action, but the threat feels very imminent at the end of season 2, and they do go so far as to cut together the minute and 30 second recap of the last episode, which is interesting because this is part one of a 2-episode arc.
I mean, and colloquially, it's known as the second part of a 3-episode arc, arc called the Dominion Introduction.
Yeah.
The beginning of this episode affords us a really fun bit of business, Ben, because this is a binge watch moment where we've gone through a passage of time with respect to our actors, and we've noticed a few differences to both the characters and the station itself in some fun ways. You want to enumerate those?
Well, we start with the McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
Where Kira is doing some, they've like analyzed the defensive capabilities of the station W/R/T, the ticks that the Jem'Hadar fly around. And her hair is grown out a little bit, slightly more hair on her head than she's had in previous seasons. Then the camera pans over to Dax. Dax has got a whole new haircut. What?
Dax has got Pioneer Woman hair.
She's got like Pioneer Woman hair with some sci-fi flair. Like the shape of it is all Pioneer Woman, but the way the locks are like tied into like regular fins on the sides heading toward the back is real advanced, you know? Pioneer Women didn't have time for that shit.
Yeah, Pioneer Women didn't have the volume that she's able to achieve.
Well, she's always had, like, perplexing volume, right? Like, her previous haircut was tended to be a ponytail, but, you know, up on the top of her head, she definitely had something assisting the hair to pop up as much as it did.
It's gotten symmetrically embiggened. Like, it's taller and wider and deeper.
She's gone to Volumizing Shampoo University and graduated summa cum laude.
Neutrogena T-Gel. It works.
Interesting choice, Ben, because, like, Nana Visitor famously was like, Kira would never have hair that took this much work.
right.
to style. And so she had it cut off. But this is a hairstyle that clearly takes a lot of work to make happen. And Dax is a person that we know to like get in wrestling matches in her quarters.
Yeah.
Like this does not appear to be the hair of an 800-year-old being. It seems fussy.
But I think Dax is really into like leaning into the gender expression of its host, you know? Like,
yeah.
So when Dax is a dude, it's like the dutiest dude, right? Like all the stories about Curzon are about like womanizing and drinking and getting in fights and shit. And Jadzia is like a super feminine character.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like a major departure, but it definitely bespeaks a good deal of time has passed since the last episode, you know?
Yeah.
You don't just leave work with a pony and show up the next day with this.
This feels like, in a number of ways, this is the season where Riker got the beard. Because, I mean, that the hairstyles have changed, the com badges have changed, Odo's makeup and costuming has changed.
Yeah, is it the belt that they added?
I think his entire costume is different than what it was in the previous season. But one crucial aspect that has changed, I think the lighting on the station is different. This feels a lot like a change between incandescent and LED lighting.
Mm.
Lights around the station feel a lot brighter to me.
Yeah, they glow in the camera more, maybe?
Yeah.
I feel like they're shooting into them a lot more in this episode.
Yeah. They're having this McLaughlin group with Sisko absent, and he makes sort of a grand entrance that shocks those around this meeting.
It's a little bit like Bruce Wayne showing up at the fundraiser for Harvey Dent by landing on the helipad and helping three babes in different color dresses out of his helicopter.
Yeah.
All of the alarms on the station, like, go off at once, and they're reading some kind of anomaly.
Distance 300 meters.
300 meters?
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving, and it ain't us!
They speculate that this may be a cloaking device, and indeed it is, Adam. We cut to the exterior, and a ship comes out of cloak. A ship that the like of which we have never seen.
It's definitely a Federation starship, but I've never seen that design before.
Like a 50-year-old man coming back from a car lot with a brand new Ford Mustang. Like, it feels very midlife crisis and Sisko here rolling up with his T-tops convertible ship.
Yeah.
The Defiant is a pretty rad looking, pretty stubby bit of business.
Yeah, it's flat and sleek. It's hard to tell scale wise where it's at because it's, it doesn't quite look like any other Starfleet ship. I mean, it's such a cool bit of design because it's like unmistakably Starfleet-y, but it's not like anything we've seen before, you know?
It kind of looks like the Federation impression of a Jem'Hadar ship, and I don't think that's an accident.
Yeah, it's got a beetle-y profile.
Yeah.
That thing got a Hemi?
Yeah.
Sweet.
He's very excited about this new ship. He beams aboard, and they have a second consecutive McLaughlin group, Adam.
Issue two.
They move into the larger conference room, and he's given them the down low on the Defiant. And he had a hand in designing this thing. In the post-Wolf 359 world, when Starfleet was looking at ships that are explicitly designed for combat so that we can kill Borgs, what would that look like? They came up with this.
I love its backstory. It reminds me of that ship they ran into in the wrecking yard that was that lowrider class ship that was destroyed in one glancing shot because it was so full of explosives.
Right. It's a real hot rod, right? It's like, he says it's overpowered and overgunned for a ship of its size.
And I love that it's imperfect. And I think that's crucial. Like, it would be so easy for them to arrive into season three with like a cheat code weapon.
Right.
Where that is like purpose built to solve the problem that we created at the end of season two. But they cop to right away this being an imperfect solution to a terrifying problem. Like, they spend the entire first part of the episode talking about how in every simulation they lose the fight. And now they have their best chance in the form of something that could end up destroying them.
Yeah, There were two things I wish they had fleshed out a tiny bit more. One is that the Borgs are no longer considered to be as big a threat, and unclear what has changed.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's insane for them to be like, they're gone and they're never coming back, and we don't have any proof of that.
I guess is it because Lore messed them up too much in that episode arc where he had all the like indie Borgs?
I mean, there are a lot of episodes that we don't see of just administration in the aftermath of the Descent episodes that I would really like to know a little more about.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that he says just kind of offhand is that there's a Romulan cloaking device on it. And when did we get to be big friends with the Romulans to the extent that they would give a piece of super classified technology to us? Even with a custodian.
When you want a cloaking device, it's going to come with that. But I'm not quite clear on what the relationship is that has made this possible.
I mean, like the explanation we get in passing from the Romulan officer that's been dispatched to, you know, be hall monitor for the cloaking device is that the Romulans don't want the Dominion to have any influence over the Alpha Quadrant. So it's seen as like a state priority. But, like, how the fuck are the Romulans so aware of what a huge threat the Dominion poses? I just don't get it.
I don't know. I mean, this is T-Rule, and she gets to walk around with a cat basket and a phaser. Like, that seems like something that, in spite of their professional relationship and the need for her to run the cloaking device, that they wouldn't allow.
Yeah. We're going to have to suspend a lot of disbelief to accept the cloaking device aspect of this ship.
She's not there to make friends, Ben.
Yeah.
In short order, she leaves this McLaughlin group, leaving behind another person, Lieutenant Commander Michael Eddington, who makes it clear he is there to make friends. He's sort of a Lieutenant Toast type.
I'm Lieutenant Commander Michael Eddington, Starfleet Security.
Holden Toast Man!
When he follows his boner into Kira, I was like, oh, Jesus. Like, this is going to be our B story, is him chasing Kira around.
Charming.
We never see him.
Yeah. It's fun to plant a writing seed that big and never address it within the episode that you planted it in.
Yeah.
Like, that's almost something that, like, we mainly associate with Disco, you know?
Yeah.
But they're doing that here.
You're telling me Eddington's going to be of concern later on?
I mean, I recognized him, so I think he's in more than one episode. I don't think they introduce a character by announcing him by name and then never have him back, you know?
Right.
Daddy came back from the car lot with his fancy car, but he also came back with a mission, Adam.
That was a well-timed horn.
That mission is to go into the Gamma Quadrant, despite the fact that the Jem'Hadar expressly forbade that, and attempt to establish a diplomatic relationship with the Founders, the mysterious people that run the Dominion.
Founders who have never been seen, who everyone who describes them has said they may or may not even exist. It is purely speculative right now, this mission.
It's such a Starfleet move, though. Like,
yeah.
If we could just talk to them. You know,
it's ultimate exploration too.
Yeah,
like the entire board is open for them. They're just gonna see what they can find, and what better way than in a cloaked ship?
What are you doing now?
A lot has changed in the intervening, you know, summer break. And one of those things is that the Starfleet higher-ups have decided that Odo is not going to be in charge of everything related to security on the station. Like, he can be the mall cop for the promenade, but he can't be chief of station security. And that's where Eddington comes in. And Odo's pretty cheesed by this.
My resignation will be logged within the hour.
I don't think he's ever felt like his job's been safe, and he takes this as a man who was expecting this to happen. Resigned, yet angry about it.
Yeah, I mean, if Worf had been held to the standard that Odo's being held to, though, like, things would have changed pretty radically on the Enterprise, you know? Like, the reason he's being removed is that there have been some security breaches.
Yeah, no shit. like allowing Quark to walk totally unpunished episode after episode.
Allowing Fishy Bajorans to just board the station without any questioning.
What would you say you do here?
These are all career-limiting moves, Ben.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that Worf is not guilty of that Odo is that Odo's not a team player. Like, he's kind of recalcitrant and resists the moves that Starfleet makes to try and get him to comply with their procedures. And, you know, that's just not good politics. So,
boy, Ben, that's a great call, because it makes me think that maybe that's why Quark continues to be unpunished for his many crimes. Like, he's a fun guy to be around. Odo is not.
Yeah, there is a ton of tension between Odo and Sisko in this episode, and Odo considers this to be racism.
Yeah.
Which is another, like in the last episode, Quark saying, I have lots of friends that are humans, like the writer's turning to camera a little bit.
Yeah, the portrayal of racism in front of Avery Brooks's character is an ongoing thing, and it's fascinating to see happen.
For an actor that is, like, I'm sure dealt with tons and tons of racism coming up through the ranks in Hollywood, that must be a hard position for Avery Brooks to play, to, like, put yourself in the shoes of the oppressor.
I also don't believe he would accept this in the way that Colm Meaney said he wouldn't be in an episode with a leprechaun.
Right.
You know?
But, like, that, this isn't about race, like, explain it away thing that he says, I think is kind of the knee-jerk defense of somebody who's doing a thing that has racist results for reasons that they do not think of as racist.
Right.
And that's a really interesting position to put this character in. Like, I think he believes it when he says it, you know? Usually racism takes the form of, like, ignoring the fact that it's a structure that is all around us, and that's why, like, people that aren't, like, avowed racists can do things that have racist results, and this is an example of that. And this scene cuts right to Jake Sisko eating a bowl of pudding. So, like, it really rubs it in your face.
Kids love Gentle Brand pudding.
Real tone shift here.
I know you thought I was just spending the entire time virtue signaling at him, but I was really setting up a joke about Jake eating pudding.
He is, he's almost brought to full release eating this pudding. We get the sense that they have been gone for a very long time, because this is a food product that Jake has missed for the duration of their travels. I like that the show has used the break between season 2 and 3 as a time technology, as to encourage us into believing that they have been gone for that amount of time. They were gone long enough to miss food.
Yeah.
They were gone long enough for Sisko to take some meetings and pack up some of his effects and bring them back to the station. They were gone long enough to feel like they were homesick.
Yeah. I feel like if I had a 2,000-year-old mask that was of unspeakable value, I might not take it back to the station that has a target painted on it right now. Personally,
yeah,
like
yeah, I might leave it at home for safekeeping.
I don't quite understand the logic of this, but like, this scene is all about, we are gonna put away the Sisko that is somewhat unsure of his commitment to being stationed here. We are now 1,000% in this station with Sisko, who by the way has also been to the hairdresser and had some changes made. You know, he's gone from, like, a 3 on the clipper to, like, maybe a 1 or a 2 on the clipper.
Yeah, he looks good.
Yeah.
You know, Ben, describing Ben Sisko's new domesticity, at Deep Space Nine makes me think about how we as viewers might begin to feel that same way through him. It's the beginning of season three. This show is becoming confident and more permanent. And maybe this is a place that we're going to end up living in for six or seven seasons like TNG. I don't think this is an accident that he's feeling this way at this moment in time, because I think we're supposed to feel the same way.
We're supposed to, and I think we do. The show being renewed for a third season after 26 episodes of season two is, you know, this is the Trek that we have now.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty exciting place to be.
He doesn't unpack for long before having to repack what is probably a small bag to board the Defiant again, because they got to go on this mission to the Gamma Quadrant, and they are, so they load up the ship with Sisko, O'Brien, Bashir, Kira, Dax, Quark, T-Rule, and after equivocating for a while, Odo at the last second.
Yeah, Odo was like hanging out on the promenade, and Kira came up and said, like, hey, the Bajoran government gave me a call and said they really want you on this Defiant mission. And he was like, bull fucking shit. He really called her on her bluff. And
yeah.
So we really think that, like, he is going to be Audi 5000, but instead...
I would like permission to come aboard. I'm here at the request of the Bajoran government.
I mean, if you were a big fan of Robert McKee's story, who'd you want him to bunk with, Ben?
The most hilarious oil to his water, Quark.
Do you need to give Odo quarters? I think you could find a janitor's closet for him.
Right.
What does he even care?
You could just find the air vent that Tom Cruise would be crawling around in if this was a Mission Impossible film is big enough to hold the bucket. That's all you need for Odo, right?
Could Odo turn himself into an aquarium with realistic fish inside?
When the chewing gum got smashed onto him, would he explode as water with fish, or would he explode as glop like we saw in that Mirror Universe episode?
He's not shape-shifting enough.
Yeah, I mean, we see him go to bucket mode, but that's just about it.
Yeah, he gets super pissed at Quark because he needs a little privacy. He needs a modesty screen for when he goes into the bucket.
Yeah.
Because he gets really irritated that Quark wants to hang out with him. And so Quark turns his back during the shift.
And Quark is there because the Negus talked to Sisko about needing a Ferengi voice in this diplomatic mission. And the Negus was so forcefully behind this idea that he sent his own scepter with Sisko to provide a forceful argument for Quark, who initially really resists being on this mission.
Are we to believe that this is an authentic scepter?
Yeah, couldn't you just replicate the sept?
Kind of seemed like this was a con job to me, like in tone. And I'm only saying that because of Avery Brooks's portrayal here. He's like, there is just a little bit of ham on his performance, and I don't feel like it's totally because Ben Sisko is relishing the idea of twisting Quark's arm into this.
Yeah.
I think there's something else going on.
I thought it was pretty messed up the way he put the scepter between his legs and then extended it like a boner toward Quark and said, kiss my scepter.
Yeah, his many pelvic thrusts in this scene were a little out of character.
Quark just closes his eyes and says, I'm happy to serve the Negus, and opens his mouth as wide as he can. Cut to black.
Their complement is full now, and so they journey through the hole that is Worm. They hit the cloak right away. Ben, I don't think we can be sure whether or not you can go through the wormhole under cloak, but I don't know why you wouldn't if you could.
You have to assume that you can't, because they say, yeah, I want to turn that thing on the second we get through.
Yeah.
And that means, like, the lights dim. There's, like, we've had relatively few times on ships that are going to cloak before now, so it's fun to get a sense of, like, what you go through when you are under cloak. It's a little like rigging for silent running in a submarine film.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in this ep, and it's really fun. We get our first example of this when a couple of Jem'Hadar ticks are out on patrol doing a flyby, and Sisko uses this as a chance to see if they can be picked up on their radar while under cloak.
Yeah, that we cut to Jem'Hadar Jonesy, who says he thinks he heard singing when they were flying by.
I think my favorite part of this is, there, you know how there's like that white noise, ship noise that you get on Federation ships?
Yeah.
When they cut main power, I haven't noticed this before in Star Trek, but all of that goes away, and all the dialogue sounds like it's in a sound booth.
Yeah.
I really like that.
That was cool. That was very cool sound design. And there's like... there's plateaus of it, right? Like when they go to cloak, but they're still at warp, it's one sound environment. And when they cut main power and go to full stop, it's a totally different one. It's all in the kind of subcognitive soundscape of it.
Yeah.
You're not like thinking about hearing it. You're just like aware that a thing has changed.
I love how, it, like you're saying, how it's not AB, but it's like many tracks being added and removed. That's compounding.
Right.
It's great. Golden cotton.
The first stop is this planet that the Ferengis have established a Tulaberry wine trade pact with. And I was really excited for this to be a reprisal of the muscle face kink aliens. The old kink lord guys. But it wasn't them. That's not who the Ferengi wound up making that deal with. And who they did make a deal with is a guy that is obsessed with metallurgy. He keeps like looking up close at different objects around the bridge of the Defiant and assessing what materials he thinks it's made out of.
Yeah, this guy's Orinthar, and he is openly negotiating with Quark on the bridge. Kind of a strange place to be doing that bit of business.
My sense is that they probably had time to build a bridge and not much else for the Defiant at this point.
Yeah.
But like I have read that they wanted to have a starship on Deep Space Nine after really struggling as a production to do bridge scenes on runabouts where there's just not that much room.
Yeah.
And this really lets them kind of move around and have fun. So I think, you know, this is a really cool bridge set, and I imagine the temptation was just too great not to maximize the amount of time they had shooting with it.
This negotiation between Orinthar and Quark is ostensibly about Tulaberries, but it's also about sussing out some details about the Founders, because Orinthar is a guy who would know.
And Sisko and Quark are kind of good cop, bad copping him, where they kind of twist his arm, and so he puts it up on screen, the Kalanon system, and we get on the main viewer on the Defiant Bridge, a look at the star systems surrounding them, and one thing on that screen really catches Odo's eye.
What is that? It is the Omarian Nebula.
And it is like hypnotizing, like Vigo's painting in Ghostbusters 2. Like, he is totally entranced. Yeah. Like, everyone else is going on and on about the Kalanon system and its deep well of pink lotion you put on chicken pox. But Odo is...
Hey, you can also use it for poison oak.
Right. But Odo's got only one thing on his mind, and it's that nebula.
Yeah.
Odo is kind of the Data of Deep Space Nine, in that he is very powerful and destructive if he wants to be. And I would sort of be on alert anytime I was around him for any change in behavior, like what we're seeing.
Right.
That could potentially make him dangerous and possibly able to steal a ship.
He does sort
to go
of
on
have
his own private mission.
Data is being influenced by an unknown third party vibes when he sees that nebula.
Yeah.
And, I guess there just haven't been that many Odo is an evil bad guy episodes aside from that one, right?
Yeah. The Defiant pulls up to this relay station at Kalanon, and it's O'Brien and Dax that beam over. And there's a nifty bit of production choice happening here, Ben, that I'm curious about whether or not you got, which was like the establishing scenes of them doing tech to this stuff are very smooth and controlled, like to establish their control of the moment. But the shots that follow, when they do a little bit of shot, reverse shot as they're communicating with Sisko.
Yeah.
The shots that follow are obscured by things and also go handheld, which really serve to jack up the tension of what's to come.
Yeah, because that handheld feels like POV. It doesn't feel like the fly on the wall where we're just watching something that's happening. It's we are in somebody's head who is watching something that's happening. And it really amps up the unease. And to their credit, like the way the performances are, they're reacting to the fact that like it's quiet, too quiet, and maybe we should get out of here, but they haven't perceived a threat around them aside from that, and they're not playing they're not pegging the needle with the music or anything. They're just letting that tension build kind of naturally.
And isn't it interesting how like the absence of a threat when a threat is expected is a threat in and of itself?
Yeah.
That's fun.
It's fun. And it's also like when you beam down to a set, it's not always that it looks this cool. Like it's really like layered space. There's lots of interesting objects in it. You kind of get the sense that everything you're seeing has a purpose that it was designed for. It. Like early TNG, you beam down to like a science lab or something, and it's just like full of beeps and boops and goo-gahs, that miscellaneous science shit. And that's not how this feels.
And importantly, those sets are shot wide.
Right.
And they don't do that here, and I think that's crucial. Like,
yeah.
It's claustrophobic and good. Like, if all the money you have is to fill up this amount of set space with your best stuff, this is what they did, and they shot it great.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like beaming over to a Borg cube.
Tonally, it feels that way, too. Like, when they first beam over, when the Borgs are asleep, and no one's regarding them as a threat. It feels very much like that in this scene too.
Yeah, and then when they get got, the camera kind of like walks around to behind them, and then like a sheet of metal like slides in front of them, cutting them off from the rest of the space.
Yeah.
Hand goes on Dax's back.
We've lost contact with them.
You don't see it coming because everything comes out of the shadows, and it's really a really scary moment, and then it's cut to the Bridge of the Defiant, and we don't hear from them again.
The reason we don't cut back to them is because the Ticks have found the Defiant. They have found them even though they're cloaked.
They have this decision to make, right? Like, do we decloak and engage these guys and try and save our friends O'Brien and Dax?
In order to use the phasers, we will have to decloak. That means we'll be seen by the Jem'Hadar.
Or do we try and sneak out of here?
We can't just leave them there.
It's Sisko's do we seal the bilge bay moment.
Right. He's a commander. He's passed the same test that Deanna Troi did.
Yeah. He sent Geordi to his death dozens of times just for fun.
Yeah. That's it. When he goes down to Quark's bar, that's the holodeck program he loves to fire up. Kill Geordi.
Bullshit, man. It's just bullshit.
This really horrifies Bashir, but it is exactly what the Romulan lady wants. And so they start to make arrangements to leave, and they call Odo up to the bridge, and Odo's like, sorry, I'm in too bad of a mood. Not coming up.
I read something on Twitter that really made me upset.
Somebody said I had a face for radio, and it really hurt my feelings.
To the best we can tell, he's just looking at the star chart that has the Omerian Nebula on it. Like, that's all he's doing.
Yeah, he's just in his room jacking it to that star chart. and Kira walks in on him, and he's like, oh!
Do you think Odo makes his dick as big as possible when he jacks it? Or do you think he's all about verisimilitude and, like, gives himself an average size crank?
I mean, Odo could make 20 dicks and arms to jack him. Like, he could do anything.
Like, nothing is too exotic for him.
Yeah, his onanism time must be a real Baroque affair.
God, like, I feel like I tell a dick joke and then you tell the college term paper version of that dick joke. Like, thanks, Ben. Thanks for telling the most purely distilled version of that. Like, there's nowhere for me to go. Yes and is like yes and in 20 different languages, like single spaced and perfectly printed out.
Yeah, I'm not using an exotic font that makes my paper look longer than it is.
Your yes and belongs in the Louvre.
Morn.
Sweet.
Morn.
Evening, everybody.
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
they have like a real heart to heart, right? Like Kira comes in and he's like, I don't know what to even think about this, but ever since I saw that thing, like it's all I want to think about and I'm obsessed with going there.
I love the way that Kira describes friendship. It's transactional.
I'm your friend. You know, the one who comes to you when she needs help.
But in saying that it's transactional, it's not without emotion. She's like...
Right, it's not cynically transactional.
In a very efficient amount of dialogue, she's able to draw him out. And she also draws out a girder that falls on her about a second later. Like, this scene isn't concluded before the bangers start dropping.
Right, they kind of get cut off. And yeah. So they can smell through the cloak. And yeah, because they're cloaked when we cut back up to the bridge and...
Cloaked and also main power deactive,
right?
Because that vocal sound effect has changed too.
Yeah, and they're already pretty banged up by the time they come out of cloak, but it's also a really uneven fight. And this is a really fun action sequence where we get to see what the Defiant is made of, because it is getting bangers dropped on it left and right, and it stays in the fight. And when it turns and starts licking shots in the atmosphere... It takes a Jem'Hadar ship out pretty quickly. Like, they're at least a weapons match, if not defensively matched with the Jem'Hadar.
The stakes are high because we're told right away people are dying. And the way that the Defiant opens up on these ticks, it's like Jesse Ventura's gun from The Predator. Like, it is a rate of fire on these torpedoes we've never seen before. And it is awesome.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's so much more visceral of space combat than we've typically gotten in Star Trek, you know? Like,
yeah.
We see the D rotating slowly in space to take phaser shots at a Romulan warbird from time to time. It's never like... active and physical, but like there's fire and smoke on the bridge of the Defiant from jump, and it is intense.
Yeah, if there were an equivalent amount of damage to the D would not be in the fight.
Right. You know, we're cutting back and forth from the bridge to space to the lower decks where Odo is helping Kira get out from under that girder, and the Jem'Hadar board the ship. They beam right through the shields, and there's like a melee of Star Trek fighting. We got Odo and Kira fighting Jem'Hadar. We cut back up to the bridge. A bunch more Jem'Hadar beam on. Sisko, the Romulan lady, Bashir, like everybody is Star Trek fighting.
Everyone gets an axe handle. There's an axe handle for everyone.
Those axe handles were fast as lightning, and I gotta say, it was a little bit frightening.
It has got to hurt so bad to punch a Jem'Hadar in the face. It's all bone.
They got toothy faces.
And you never see anyone do that punch and then shake their hand afterwards. I think that would be welcome here.
Yeah, like, shouldn't Starfleet be issuing knuckle dusters to everybody that's stationed on a ship that may be operating within wormhole proximity?
Also seems like a fight that is not good for dustbusters, because I think you want a butt of a rifle... sized weapon.
Yeah, and the Jem'Hadar are really down to use a rifle, but
yeah,
one of them gets out a hand phaser and hits Kira, and she goes down, and it's heavily implied that she dead, but we fade back up from black, and she not dead.
Yeah, we get a what feels like a fairly rare passage of time fade to black and fade up.
Yeah, but when it does fade back up, she's on a shuttle, and she's been kind of resisting this idea. Odo has been pushing for shuttle hangs so that he can go check out this Neb, and she's been like, no, dude, this is that's not what we're doing right now. And so she's kind of angry when she wakes up and finds out that that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things at work, right? There's what she thought was a resolution to the Odo needing a shuttle and wanting to go explore the nebula issue, but there's also the disorientation of waking up in a car or something that I think we have experienced at one time or another in our life.
Right.
Like, famously, a couple of my good friends woke up on an airplane going to Vegas after after a bender of a particular note. Like,
really?
This is... It's not my story to tell, but some very good friends of mine at the height of our drinking and gambling debauchery.
Are you gonna Jackie and Lori me their names, or am I just gonna have to speculate on which of your friends?
You've never met them, unfortunately.
Okay.
Yeah, they are. The way the story was told to me was they woke up on the plane having had no idea how they got there and just sort of piecing it together in a hangover refractory state, like on descent into Las Vegas airport. They proceeded to spend what I think was 24 hours there, like drinking themselves back into blackout drunk, to the degree that when they got back to the airport for the return flight home, one of them didn't have a shoe, and the TSA agent told them that they couldn't go through TSA unless they had two shoes that they could take off to go through security and then to put back on again afterwards.
That's such a stupid rule.
That is so emblematic of the security theater of TSA. So they had to go buy fucking Las Vegas flip-flops or something. One of them did anyway, in order to have two shoes to take off at security to go back through. It was a shit show of a 24-hour period. And one of the most legendary Vegas stories that I've ever heard.
Yeah,
wow. To hear it told. When you come back up here, I'll try to arrange some hangs with these guys, because that story is way better told than how I just did, and it is a fucking humdinger. It's awesome.
Well, we spend the rest of the episode with Kira and Odo, right?
Yeah, they are in the runabout, and they are headed to the Omarion Nebula, which has an M-class planet inside, Ben.
And it's not a planet that's in orbit of anything. It's described as a rogue planet.
And, yeah, I love the idea of this. It's very dark for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, despite describing it as a rogue planet, when we see a shot of it in space, there's obviously a star nearby in a sun-like proximity. But maybe it's just going by that or something. I don't know.
You'd never be able to have an M-class planet if it didn't have some sort of heat source nearby.
That's what I was thinking. What's the deal here?
Maybe it's a rogue planet with a rogue star. What else are you going to do but beam down to this planet?
I mean, Odo is being drawn by something he knows not what.
And he tells Kira in the shuttle that, like, the last time we saw the Defiant, it was adrift in space. Sort of like a, hey, there's not anything to go back home to.
Yeah, your friends are dead.
So there's no urgency to get back, and I think that's crucial in Kira's allowing this little side trip to happen.
Right, because like they've had such a close relationship in the past, and she really did try and do him a solid by arranging to get him on this ship and stuff. Like she's really trying to help him. She knows how much distress he's in. But then he turns around and like Captain Potters her, going like, I want to go to the nebula. Now. And she feels very hijacked into this. Like she is mad at him for doing it. But there's a tone shift, man. Like when they come through the woods and find a lake that looks like Odo in his bucket, and Odo types start coming out of this lake, she takes a step back and one of these Odo types walks up and welcomes Odo home.
They found Planet Bucket. It's got to be so awkward for Kira to be like, could you imagine how she's feeling? We never see her in this two shot, which I think is fine. Like that's the correct choice because it's not about her. It's about like this crucial moment in Odo's backstory.
Yeah, it's not even two shot. It's like dirty singles.
Yeah, but like Kira has got to be so awkward.
Right, because like the deal with Odo, which has been reestablished, being in bucket mode is embarrassing nudity to him. And these guys just all took their dicks out.
We're Mr. Buckets. Buckets are fun.
It's like a lake full of dicks. Imagine the smell.
I keep thinking I had the title to this episode. Now I'm not so sure.
It's not going to be Lake Full of Dicks.
Why not? That's like a perfect Greatest Gen title. Baroque Jack Sesh or whatever that shit I said before was also. But
I think we have a number of candidates.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it shakes out.
Did you like the episode, Ben?
I did. I liked this one a lot more than I liked the the previous episode that set it up. It feels like the first of a two-parter, you know?
Yeah.
And it makes me understand the naming convention a little bit better. Like, I know why they've recapped the last episode, but this felt self-contained enough that I don't think we totally needed it. And this has been something we've been wondering about Odo up until now. Like, the mystery of what he is and where he came from is an established character thing, and it's not always a great choice for a TV show to answer a question like that, but this is a fun way to answer it.
What they've done is, instead of make Odo's origin story a sidecar to everything else, which is what it has been up until now, they're tying that to the main conflict in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Like this is now related to everything else that's going on. And so it's not going to feel like a side mission anymore.
Right.
When he explores this stuff.
Did you like the episode, Adam?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it felt like a war movie to me in a way that I liked. I think the stakes were high. People are dying. I like it anytime the Federation feels outgunned. I think that is a great place to tell a story.
Sure.
And we've now felt that way for a couple of episodes. That's good to me.
Yeah. You know what's good to me, Adam?
What's that?
Folks that go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron and arrange to have Priority One messages read out loud on the show. Should we check to see if anybody has done that for this episode?
Yeah, let's do that.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone could be enough to buy this ship.
Ben, our first Priority One message is from Leah. It is for Mike. And the message goes like this. Life is like a hurricane here in Duckburg. Race cars, lasers, aeroplanes. It's like a duck blur. Yes, I paid $100 just to duck roll you. Yes, it was worth it.
Whoa.
Depending on when this airs, I hope you will have had fun in Japan.
Wow.
Eternal blue, forever green, Sounders till I die. Hey, you're pal Leah.
Is duck rolling a thing is that like a thing that's just between Leah and Mike, or do people duck roll each other?
This is my first time
participating in the lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah, so typically when I see something like this for the first time, I just like to hang back, work on a snack-sized bag of chips, just kind of feel out the territory.
Yeah, because you don't want to look like an idiot the first time you get your duck wet.
Ben, do we have another Priority One message?
We do. It is from Dan, and it's for Joe, and it's of a personal nature. It goes like this. Dearest Joe, 2 years ago you introduced me to The Greatest Gin, and essentially the entire concept of podcasts. This has greatly improved the way I spend time at work. Thank you for helping me enjoy my time spent in the laboratory. Warmest regards, Daniel.
Boy, can you imagine if Greatest Gen was your first podcast experience? I actually feel sorry for this person.
I mean, it's always flattering to hear. Like occasionally we've heard like, I do not listen to podcasts, but I listen to Greatest Gen. That's a really specific worldview.
And my follow-up question for Dan is, once you go Greatest Gen, do you ever go back? I don't know. I don't think so.
I feel like this guy's going to listen to like This American Life or 99% Invisible and just be like, oh, why was I listening to those idiots? This is so much better.
That's going to change his life. Well, if you want to blame anyone for turning you on, just in general, or turning you on to Greatest Gen, you can take it on over to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where personal messages like these are $100 and commercial messages are $200. They're a great, great way to help the ongoing production of Greatest Gen.
They sure are. Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible. Drunk Shimoda!
One of the most common forms that a Shimoda takes is the Chaos Agent. And Odo's the Chaos Agent in this episode, right? As soon as he gets triggered, he becomes the thing that that changes the stakes of the game. But I mean, as soon as he's taken over, as soon as he's gotten the vapors about this nebula, anything can happen.
Yeah.
Everything's on the table. So I think for that reason, Odo is going to be my pick here. What about you?
Odo is my pick as well, Adam. And it's kind of a fun, like, callback TNG trope, which is the character that something has changed for them, but they don't really tell everybody about it. They don't hit the alarm button as hard as they should.
Yeah.
He's just like, I need to get on a shuttlecraft. And he's not like, hey, there's something like really serious happening inside of me. And, you know, that he starts having that reaction before they're in big trouble with the Jem'Hadar. So he had time to say it.
He's not as chatty as Shimoda, that's for sure. Moms, can't live with them, can't find a great gift for them. It's madness, and it's the same every year. Mother's Day comes around, and it's like, what's it gonna be this year? Another robe? Another candle? Slippers? A sweater? Flowers? We've got to do better than that, right? Well, you can, and it's actually the best gift you could possibly give a loved one, an Aura frame. Now, we have a policy to only do ads on our show for things that we actually like and use, and I gotta tell you, the Aura frame is probably the best gift I've ever given. The folks I've given an Aura frame to love it, and I love it too, because when you give an Aura frame, you're not just giving a person a bunch of old pictures, you're giving them new pictures. Every time you send one, do it. Right now, Aura has a great sale for Mother's Day. Viewers can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, and the code is SCARVES at checkout to show your support for the show. Terms and conditions apply.
Mother's Day is coming up, and one of the best gifts you can give a mom that you might share a bed with is doing some yard work downstairs, if you know what I mean, with Manscaped. This season, make sure you groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders in below the waist grooming. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants to let the mother of your children know how much you appreciate her continuing to put up with you.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Well, what do you say you tell me what's coming up in the next episode?
I'd be happy to do that, Adam. The next episode is Season 3, Episode 2, The Search Part 2. Odo and Kira have landed on a lone planet in the Omarion Nebula, which they have discovered is Odo's homeworld. That's, of course, the Netflix description, which could just be the description of the last scene in this episode we just watched.
Yeah.
The Amazon description is, while Odo struggles to learn the ways of his people, Sisko discovers that the price of peace with the Dominion may be too high.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they may be talking about Dax and O'Brien as those stakes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe Quark can help them negotiate a more bargain-friendly rate? I don't know.
I mean, this is the, I think, the second time in four episodes that O'Brien's been kidnapped by an adversary, so
yeah.
Not great luck for him.
Yeah, O'Brien's having a rough span of months.
Well, looking forward to that.
Do you want to roll them bones, Adam, and see what we do with this episode?
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
We've got a especially high stakes this time around because three of the six squares in front of us lead to Quark's bar, and two of them lead to Quark's bar that are back in time on the board.
I played a bunch of craps in Vegas when we were down there, Ben, and so I'm feeling deeply unlucky as I as I roll this dice.
Oh, no.
And I've rolled a two.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
Which narrowly hops us over.
Wow.
The longest wormhole we have on the board.
Yeah.
Into square number 88.
That is that's breathtaking, Adam, because we almost reset the clock quite a bit.
I think that could have been fun. I mean, I don't know what happens when we reach the end of this board and we do Mournhammered.
Yeah, that could be.
I mean, does the game cease? I don't think we're ready to answer that question.
Here's a question. Like, if we're on 97 and we roll a 5, does it just loop around or do we have to land on Mournhammered at the end?
And what happens when we complete square 100? We don't have answers to any of these questions.
Yeah. Does the board game change? Does it just start over? Who knows?
The board unfolds a completely new board after that. I think that'd be fun.
It goes to three-dimensional.
Surprise board.
Three-dimensional game of buttholes.
Yeah. I mean, I love the title. You sold me.
Felipe would have too much work on his hands designing it. I think we got a great website. We gotta like lean into that. It's gach.biz/game to follow along with this. Adam, that will be the next episode. Looking forward to doing it stone cold sober. In the meantime, let's thank the great Dark Materia and perhaps even greater Adam Ragusea for all the music that you hear on the program.
Yeah, incredibly fortunate to have Adam Ragusea making music for us.
He's one of the greatest.
He makes music for our shows. He makes music for our special donors-only feed shows.
Yeah.
If you support The Greatest Generation or Friendly Fire or any of the other Maximum Fun shows, that gets you access to our special donors-only episode content that includes live show episodes and special episodes on movies like Hunt for Red October and Gremlins and
yeah.
A bunch of other great stuff.
We really pull out the stops for those donor bonus content eps, and I think they are really worth the price of admission. It's maximumfund.org/donate if you're not already a member.
Gotta thank all our friends of DeSoto who are chatting up each other over on Facebook and Twitter using the hashtag GreatestGen. There's also Reddit pages for Greatest Generation, as well as our other show, Friendly Fire. Check out Friendly Fire if you haven't listened to that show yet. I think it's great.
Yeah, we're really proud of Friendly Fire and Greatest Discovery, even.
Our card daddy, Bill Tilly, makes fun baseball cards out of every episode that we record. He's up to hundreds and hundreds. He may even have done thousands of cards by now.
Oh, yeah, I think the chances are good that he's into the thousands at this point.
Throw him a follow on Twitter. He's Bill Tilly, 1973.
He's one of the great hangs in the world. Adam, I think that's all the thanks we have for today.
With that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine. That is as stinky as a lake full of dicks.
Boy, I'm so glad that somebody made when can I reuse this calendar.com, though, because...
God, you ever just edge a sneeze for like 10 seconds?
Was it good for you?
God, that's what I just did. That's a delight.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.